All right, recording is in progress. Good evening, everybody. My name is Cynthia Delestrinos Johnson. I'm the chair of the Community Services and Safety Committee. I'm joined by my colleagues, Councilmember Zaki Dunn and Councilmember Deshaun Quinn, along with several city staff. I recognize that there are some guests who are joining us this evening. I would love for you to come off mute if you can, just to introduce yourself so we know who's present in the room. I'll start with the people I could see. Christopher West.
Hey, good afternoon. My name is Christopher West. I'm the CEO of Cascade Behavioral Health. So thank you for having us.
Thank you. Thanks for joining us. Next person is Diana Chinea. Please correct me if I say your name, if I mispronounce your name.
That was perfect. Yes, I'm here also as a representative of Cascade Behavioral Health. Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks. And then we have Lena Stinson Ali.
Yeah, hi, my name is Lena Stinson Ali. I'm with the Community Connector Program, and I'm invited here with Nasha.
Thank you. Thanks for joining us. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in this evening. Just to give you a little bit of, I don't know if it's background or just logistics for these meetings are really short and we have a lot of things on the agenda, so there may not be an opportunity for the public or the guests to give comment. If there is time at the end, because we have a council member council meeting immediately after this one, but if there is time at the end and you want to give comments, I'll open it up at that time. But just know we are really grateful that you're here. I apologize in advance if there's not time to provide public comment. But I do want to encourage you, there is an opportunity to give public comment to the whole council. If there is something during this meeting that you'd like to make comment about at the next meeting, and I'll have Laurel at the end, if we run out of time, just give more information about how to do so. Or, you know, we'll deal with that towards the end and I'll leave time. But I want to thank you for attending and just let you know that just because of the timing of these meetings, there may not be an opportunity for public comment. Okay, so with that being said, we could just go ahead and jump right into the agenda. The first item on the agenda is an update on the Law Enforcement Training and Community Safety Act and some of the legislative reforms that happened this past legislative session. And we have Chief Drever who will be speaking to us on that topic.
Yeah, thank you, Council, for having me. Chief Eric Drever, Tocqueville Police Department. So this is a very broad topic with lots of information. So what I thought I would do is give a quick high overview, but then touch base on some of the things that are of focus here in the state pertaining to contested issues related to some of the new reform in issues that are coming up as a result of that. So prior, when this was originally scheduled for, I had sent you condensed versions of what each of the different reform measures and some of the impacts. So I thought I'd cover, again, high area review of those things. We had House Bill 1054 that was covering some of the tactics that police use, also deployment of tear gas, prohibiting use of certain pursuit tactics. A lot of these things so all of these measures took place July 25th. They went into to be active. The laws went into place. Key considerations related to House Bill 1054 is the prohibition of chokeholds or neck restraints by law enforcement. One of the contentions with this particular law is it specifically prohibits its use at all, even in a life-threatening situation. So we are working with state representatives to add language in that would not prohibit a law enforcement officer from using it to save their own life or the life of somebody else. As there's other legislation.
Go,
mute, please. We all do it.
Thank you.
That's okay. So we do have legislation and other laws on the book that specifically do allow law enforcement to use whatever measures needed to protect their own life and to protect the lives of others in using lethal force. However, this measure went a little bit further, restricting its use regardless. And so we are working with representatives to change that language so that officers don't get held accountable for violating that in a life or death situation. The other point of contention with this particular bill was the standard of when police are authorized to engage in pursuit, us having to have probable cause for a specific set of crimes. Often we don't have the probable cause at the time to be able to engage in a pursuit, which would then allow the subject of a serious crime to potentially get away. So this is something that we've addressed with state representatives. It is still in discussion. Hopefully this is something that we'll be able to work on, because in extreme situations, it will mean that law enforcement won't be able to pursue allowing individuals of serious crimes to get away, when normally the standard would have been reasonable suspicion, a Terry stop that gives us the right to stop and detain somebody while we acquire the probable cause. Similar to that, House Bill 1310 on use of force, before we are authorized to use force in law enforcement now in Washington State, this bill requires us to have probable cause before any force is used, or we must have imminent threat of bodily injury and serious harm. In this particular case also, it is quite often where we will run into somebody that is participating in a crime and our suspicion is that they're involved, and we've had the ability to stop them in the past. However, without having probable cause, we would have to let people leave the area. Now, that doesn't mean we can't try and use resources to follow or track somebody while we're trying to get probable cause. But if the person were to get into a car, we don't have the ability to pursue. It is law enforcement's belief that this is harmful to the community. A good example, or I guess an extreme case example, would be if you were to call law enforcement and say somebody just perfect stranger just kidnapped my five-year-old child. Please come and help, giving a description of a car, description of the suspect, description of the child. Coming into the area, law enforcement sees a car perfectly matching that description, sees a subject driving it matching the description. We could then turn on the car, light it up, and try and stop it. But at this point, we don't have probable cause. We need to be able to confirm that a crime actually took place and that the child is actually missing prior to being able to stop the car and having probable cause. Thus, if the person does not stop at the time that we initiate our emergency equipment and they just take off, let's say they speed, run a red light to get away, we're not allowed to pursue. In which case, we've now missed the one opportunity to save a child from being abducted. So I personally have been engaged with communications with our representatives, trying to find ways for us to find common ground so that we can detain people. Unfortunately, that does sometimes require the use of force. And similarly, finding a definition for use of force might also be helpful in this situation, because use of force in its most common definition means any unwanted touching. So for us to just lay hands or put our hands in front of somebody and their chest bumps against us in order for us to keep them from leaving, that would be considered use of force. Not everything requires use of force. There's a lot of good things in these new legislation that requires us to use de-escalation and use verbal commands. But the bottom line is, if somebody doesn't want to stay, they're free to go. We have no means for stopping them where before we did. Senate Bill 5051 refers to decertification and puts rules in place that puts more accountability on both the police department and Criminal Justice Training Commission for meeting criteria for maintaining certification. There are also standards in there that would potentially require mandatory decertification. So somebody would not be allowed to continue to be a law enforcement officer, especially as it relates to excessive use of force. If somebody is found to have used excessive force, mandating that a decertification. But all of the certifications are going to bear more scrutiny by the Criminal Justice Training Commission. Senate Bill 5066 imposed a duty to intervene. We as a department already have policy on this prior to the legislation, so the legislation is actually backing that our own policy. House Bill 1267 in the Office of Independent Investigations is now requiring the state to oversee investigations of officer-involved use of deadly force, and they're putting together a team for being able to investigate. This ties in with LaTaxa and the update that I was going to provide you on that, which is essentially the city of Tukwila and the team we participate in, the Valley Independent Investigation Team, are in compliance with the new LaTaxa laws and the management of our team. The team itself is seen as a model for the state, and we have been in compliance since the mid-year last year, and we have since broadened and brought some of the things we've learned from LaTaxa here to our own department, bringing community members in and involving them in our process, community members involved in reviewing our use of force. So it's been extremely beneficial, and we've seen it add transparency and accountability to our investigations, both here locally and as a region as we do our officer-involved shooting investigations. And then one of the other Senate bills, 5476, State versus Blake, has put into place language that requires us to provide resources and treatment to individuals that we come in contact with that have personal use drugs on them. No longer is it illegal to be carrying personal use drugs. Unless we can show that we have two contacts with an individual where we have provided them resources and opportunity for treatment, and they are still now a third time in possession of those drugs. Unfortunately, there's no system in place that ties all law enforcement together regarding contacts. So you could have two contacts in Tukwila, two contacts in Renton, two contacts in Auburn, and unless we called each agency individually, there's no database that currently shares that information. So we as Valley Chiefs are working to try and find a way for us to coordinate that so that we can best meet the needs of the community and the individuals involved. Because ultimately, the idea behind the court's decision was to get these individuals treatment. However, if these individuals that are repeatedly violating this law are not seeking that treatment and have no intent to do so, then we need to be able to be better coordinated and share the information so that it's not doesn't become a burden on the community. House Bill 1223 and the Uniform Electronic Recording of Custodial Interrogations. So now for custodial interrogations and interviewing, we're required to record them. The only exception becomes if the individual does not want us to record them, they still have a right to not be recorded. However, it is our intent to use our body-worn cameras to try and facilitate those recordings, as well as we're working here in within the Justice Center. We have some interview rooms that we're currently working to set up electronic recording and audio recording, video and audio recording for us, so that we can do proper investigations to be in compliance with that law. And that is the big overview. Right now, it's still the biggest contention related to the reform measures are this standard for probable cause before using force and the ability to pursue. and trying to find ways for us to work with the state representatives so that we don't have issues where it's impacting the community. So do you have any questions regarding the reform measures or LaTaxa? It's a lot of information to try and condense in, and I'd be glad to elaborate on any of it for you.
Thank you, Chief. I'll start with questions from my fellow council members. Councilmember Quinn.
Very familiar with this topic. I don't have any questions. Actually, I may have a question at the end, but what I do know is there's been conversations with legislators and law enforcement, and it's really a discussion of intent versus impact and finding a space where we can have kind of successful approach to universal safety as well. And I understand that conversation is constantly going, probably with fits and starts, but you know, there's a huge element where the public, you know, kind of needs to be reassured that they're going to have, you know, that universal safety and they're going to have safety. So maybe this question, and maybe this is something that our city attorney can come back with, but you know, just thinking just by the function of limitations, if the interpretation is, let's say, more stringent, that has an impact on the insurance that WCIA and or insurance that, because I believe it's the same for law enforcement. Has there been, I would say, from a kind of a municipal or a city attorney perspective, have they also been involved in the conversations over the interpretations? Because I mean, that would would kind of take some of our interpretations out of it, because WCIA sees it a certain way.
If I could answer, I don't see if Carrie is involved or on the line, she can elaborate as well. The Valley Chiefs and city attorneys and the city attorney's office was represented at a meeting where we discussed all these reform measures and the interpretations. And the bottom line was, when it comes to that language about use of force and when we have the authority, there's a very specific line in there that says we must have probable cause. And I totally agree with the intent behind the reform. The problem is we have to go off of the way the law is written, because that's what we're going to be held accountable to, especially with the laws related to the changes to our accreditation. We'd be decertified if we go with a different interpretation than what is literally written. And so, Carrie, if you're available, you might be able to talk. They have been involved in those discussions.
And I will just add to Chief Dreamer's comments in response to your question, Councilmember Quinn, that yes, WCIA has been very involved. They even hosted a seminar forum last week for WCIA member city attorneys, which I attended. And it's an ongoing interpretation issue where right now WCIA and all the member jurisdictions, including Tukwila, are just really trying to follow the black letter of the law, because there has been no test case yet. This is still so new that it hasn't gone through the court system yet. And also, we do expect next legislative session that the legislators will revisit this to provide some clarity on some of the ambiguities. So I hope that helps you answer your question.
Councilmember Edan.
Thank you, Chief. I thank you. I am not really familiar with all the you know, bills that you listed, but did kind of follow one of it, particularly 1024. I just wanted to, I think you talked about a common ground, and I was hoping if you could just elaborate what some of the common ground that you're working on. This is in relation to the imminent
danger and probable cause, use of force. What are some of the things you're hearing that? And it sounds like this is something that the legislators will definitely look at it next session. But if you care to talk about that a bit, I'd love to hear it.
Yeah, so the common ground revolves exactly around the intent behind the reason why these reform measures came into place. Furthermore, we all want transparency and accountability, which most of what this reform does do. And the intent was not to make it so that police could not pull over a kidnapper. The intent was not to put any burden on the community by allowing true criminals to get away. And I'm not using that as a blanket statement. I'm using, we have reasonable suspicion in the past. We're looking, yeah, this person matches the description of the person, like to a T. Mm-hmm. And that's still just reasonable suspicion. We need to go and confirm that an actual crime was committed before we can then have probable cause. And the intent was not to let criminals go free. Or more correctly, people suspected of criminal activity. And the intent of holding officers accountable and the transparency around how we go about doing our job, that's all common ground. We want everyone to know everything that we're doing, both good and bad, because that's how we improve. That's how we build our reputation up for doing the right thing. And when we do make mistakes, holding ourselves and those officers accountable so that we can regain some of that trust of the community. So we are all on the same page as it relates to that. The problem then becomes how we find the right language that meets that need and intent while not limiting our ability to enforce laws and hold people that are conducting criminal behavior accountable.
Okay, thank you, Chief. the other one that I wanted to understand was, and I think we do have an experience such that in the city, if an officer has a history of a repeated use of force, I think there was a bill that you talked about that addresses that, and I forgot what the bill number that was. I was hoping if you could share that, so I could maybe get more information around that. Yeah, so decertifications.
Yeah, so Senate Bill 5051 regarding decertification puts several criteria in as it relates to reporting behavior. There's also the Brady bill that revolves more around integrity than use of force. But the underlying intent is to create an environment and administrative protocols for both the department and the Criminal Justice Training Commission, which tracks the certifications, making information available so that that information about that type of behavior by an officer and or their internal investigations, things that they have been held accountable for by the department, if they try going from one department to another, mm-hmm. this information comes up so that we don't have that repeated behavior occurring somewhere else. So in other words, an officer that is the proverbial bad apple cannot just simply jump from one department to another. And I have heard, I haven't been able to confirm this, that Washington State creating these laws allows that to happen internally. But as you're aware, we're having recruitment and retention issues. We're recruiting outside the state. And so if other states don't have similar laws, we run that potential. However, our hope is that a thorough background investigation will uncover that. And that's where we start the process of vetting individuals, is when once we have an offer to hire, we then vet them. We do the thorough background investigation looking for this type of behavior so that we don't bring it here to Tacoma.
Yeah, thank you so much. And I think we need to figure out and staff that correctly, fund that correctly on if you have an issue on that. Overall, I just want to say that I am so proud of our legislators and what they were able to accomplish last year. I think these are really great laws that they put together for throughout the whole state. So very thankful of them. And then just lastly, 1223 recording interviews. I think you mentioned that maybe we don't have those equipment installed in our facilities currently right now. We'd love to kind of talk to you more about that and how we can accomplish those, make sure that we have those correct equipment, because I think it's an important piece to have those visible to the folks and make sure that there's a view of that. So I yield back. Thank you, Chief.
Thank you. I don't have any questions per se, but one thing I'm wondering, because as I understand it, you're giving us an update and also letting us know that there are certain bills that you're working on with others collaboratively to try and address some of the issues in implementation. And so my ask for you, Chief, is if you could come back to us at a later point once you and others start developing some of these suggested changes that you'll go to the legislature about, just so we're informed of the stance that our department will be taking moving forward on some of these changes.
Certainly, I can do that.
Great. Thank you so much for the comprehensive update on all those bills.
My pleasure.
All right. The next item on our agenda is an update on the Community Connectors Program, and we have Naisha Fort Brooks, our Community Engagement Manager, who will give that update.
Good evening, council members, guests, and staff. My name is Naisha Fort Brooks with the Administrative Services Department. I also have Lena Ollie Stenson. She's one of our Community Connector Advisory Committee members and also a community leader. And this evening, I just wanted to do a brief overview of the Community Connectors Program. And for our guests who are on the call, the Connectors Program was established in mid-2000 in partnership with two local nonprofit organizations to create a Community Connector program that engages our residents on civic engagement and to provide a two-way communication process for our hard-to-reach community members. One of those examples is connecting our connectors to participate in the comprehensive plan, provide input and participate and recruit other residents to join in open houses and events. However, over time, the connectors program felt they were just being used to gather data from hard to reach communities, and they were definitely surveyed burden. Oftentimes, agencies would come in, extract this community data, and would not return with any updates, leaving the connectors feel like they were being used, creating disposable leadership, and feeling like they were being racially tokenized. Additionally, due to the budget reductions associated with the pandemic and program challenges, the funding for the connector program was eliminated for 2021 and 2022. Staff felt this was a great opportunity to convene with leaders in the Tukwila community to identify what the community wanted out of a civic engagement, and those discussions led to the formulation of a Community Connector Advisory Committee. In early April of this year, I have been convening with advisory committee members to reimagine what a new Community Connector program could look like. This advisory committee would like to host informational meetings from January to March of 2022 for recruitment purposes and to answer any questions potential candidates may have. Thus far, the advisory group has been meeting every month since April to discuss and develop a draft curriculum, which is listed on page 2 of your memo. The program would continue to provide childcare, interpretation and translation, as well as culturally appropriate foods and compensation of gift cards. Next month's meeting, the advisory group will be developing a mission statement, which was never implemented when the program came to being, and also a possible new name change that is reflective of this new mission statement and the program purpose. So that being said, I would like to answer any questions you may have or if you have any questions for Lena at this time. Thank you.
Thank you, Naisha. Councilmember Quinn, do you have any questions?
No questions. I love the direction that this is going for all the reasons clearly articulated. And I really like the fact that it's the participants that will also help shape and drive the work of this group. I think that that's the next iteration or evolution of what this is, meeting people where they are and then incorporating their feedback to kind of really drive the direction. And I love the mission part and maybe even a charter process as well.
Thank you.
Councilmember Edan.
Yeah, so thank you for the update. I've said in the past that it's so good to revamp this, whatever you're, it's really great to revamp, and I'm also excited that you're leading this effort. I just do have a quick question. The list of folks that are right now on the CCA is compromised in the following. How were you able to select these folks to be in this? I just thought I asked that question and get in that maybe an understanding how that all that came together.
Sure, that's a great question, Councilmember Edan. I've worked with majority of these leaders in the past during my time at Global to Local, and just also volunteering and participating in other events within the city of Tukwila. And I identified their strengths. And one thing that I really appreciated was their authenticity of their voice and their leadership skills and what they bring to the table. And so when thinking about leaders who can show up and be ready to do this work, I knew that they would be the best individuals to participate. I definitely asked and had to provide some information and expectations on how long this process is going to take. Because when you're building a new program, particularly when it's community led, you want to take your time in doing this work. And so I'm really grateful for their participation and also their leadership development, because this is something that's going to push them in other opportunities in their career. And I wish them all the success.
Thank you so much, Ms. Brooks. I'm very supportive of the revamp 2.0, I am looking forward of the name change, particularly looking forward for the name change. I love the mission statement, I wish the best to you and the members. So I'm an advocate and a supporter of this. So thank you so much. Thank you for coming to talk to us this afternoon.
Thank you.
I'm 100% supportive of this program. I think it's so necessary, and I appreciate the work that you're doing to work with community members to shape it, because oftentimes we may think we know what the answer is, but I think, in engaging with the community in a process to allow them to have their voices to be heard, that might be something that's uncomfortable. But I personally think that this is a path forward, and that whatever the group creates is going to be, it'll be perfect for whatever it is, because you're involving them in that whole process. My question for you is really, you know, your request is for 20,000. I was wondering if you could provide a little bit more detail about how, like, what that money will be spent towards.
Yes, I'm happy to provide more information. At our next meeting, we're also going to be talking a little bit more in detail about the budget, specifically for compensation, not knowing if we're going to be in person anytime soon. So that may reduce some of our costs, but also wanting to make sure that we compensate connectors equitably in that process. And then also thinking about bringing in guest speakers for the leadership development, those, and the averages for those particular costs as well, because we want to compensate our facilitators. So it is a possibility that the cost would be between 25 and 30, but once the connectors and I break that down, we did some brainstorming last month, but we really want to get down to every single penny next month. And then when I come to the council as a whole, I'll be able to provide more of that information regarding the budget.
Perfect. And, you know, I say that because I think many of the council members are interested in this program, so don't be afraid to ask for the resources you need to have the best program that you can have. Okay, let's go with Councilmember Quinn and then Councilmember Idan. I saw your hand too.
I'm assuming we kind of got triggered by more information there. I think in, so I'll throw this out as a, for the presentation of Ms. Brooks to maybe consider, and I know there are national groups, you know, kind of similar to this, probably not 100% aligned, but there's also the benefit that actually comes out of it. So successfully engaging community members to help drive the discussions leads to, and I know that there's a list of those things, just so also the general public has an understanding of why something like this makes sense and for the type of investment, what it could also generate. And so, I mean, I have some thoughts of, on top of my head. I think there was a group in California that was brought together to look at like kind of different ways to engage the community. Then that led to policy changes, that led to resident and community groups that were formed to kind of fill the gaps. And so I think there are a lot of examples, and it might be helpful for not only us as policymakers, but for the general public to say the possibilities are, you know, the potential is significant, and these are the kind of things that come out of groups or an intentional effort like this.
Councilmember Idan?
Yeah, so one thing that I forgot to mention, the earlier times when we talked about it is around language access. As you know, I think we're a very diverse community. And so when I think about, or when I hear about hard to reach communities, you know, the question that comes to my mind is, why is it hard to reach community, right? So some of it is language access, some of it not knowing, and there are other things out there. I know, when I talk to someone from the East African community, they will tell me an issue, and then I will say, you know, I can bring that up on the council, but can you come to public comment? You don't need to speak English. You know, I'll help you fill out the form. Go ahead and say it. They'll find a translator if you tell them ahead of time. So making sure that people know that they can come and talk about the issues that they see in their community. These are folks that have lived in this community for a long time. So figuring some sort of an understanding or a feel or just putting together a language access when it comes to a barrier to our system of government. And then how do we, overcome that? So just, I'm not looking for a response, but something to think about within this program. How do we address that issue? I yield back.
Thank you. Thank you, Naisha, for attending. Thank you, Lena, for your participation in the process and also for attending this meeting. Lena, do you want to say anything before we move on to the next agenda?
Actually, I think, yes. So I'm not sure if you know my background. I work for a Health Point at Tequila Clinic as a supervisor for Connection Desk. And what I do, I connect a client with the available resources and help them navigate the healthcare system as a whole. So for me, as an immigrant myself, the community connector it's not only just civic engagement, or it's not just electoral politics and voting, but also it's learning how the process of being a civic in our communities and also that can bring a positive outcome and make changes in our community. And I also see, I think it was mentioned about language. For me, the participation and engagement can help immigrants, especially in the refugee community, to build language skills and also help them in this process to feel like at home and they belong somewhere. So that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Thank you.
I just want to add one more just quick thing. I appreciate what you mentioned. Sorry I didn't get your name. Ms. Brooks, one of the things could be like, if you get someone from the community that knows and understands that has worked with you, and they go talk to different communities about civic engagement in their language and in their, to show them where can you find these documents? How can you contact your councilman? How can you reach out? How can they reach out to you if they have an issue? You do that, twice a year or three times a year. They know who you are. They're able to pick up the phone and connect anyone from our city. And sometimes there is that, I don't know who works in that city hall kind of thing. And it's hard, people that they know and trust that they've seen a few times, makes a whole lot of difference. Thank you.
Thank you. Naisha, did you want to say anything before we close this item out?
In regards to language skills, Councilmember Edan, and to what Lena was sharing earlier, over the past couple of weeks, I've been interacting with different community members who have reached out to me personally, asking me some questions where they just don't feel comfortable reaching out. And that's something that we're hoping to bring this tool to our participants. We're going to be calling them a cohort in the Connectors program. And even if they didn't even speak English, I still want them to participate. I still want them to apply. We will make sure that we have the proper documentation. Oftentimes, our documentation is very wordy. They can't understand the terminology. So I would work with that community member to make sure that it's translated in a way that they can understand it, to simplify it, that they understand it based off their lived experience. But I do 100% agree with you that we will make sure that language will not be a barrier for this program. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Naisha. All right, we will go on to our next item on the agenda, and this is an update on the Cascade Behavioral Health Safety issue, and we have Chief Drever here who will start us on this discussion.
Yeah, thank you. This topic came up with citizen comments from council last week, And with the concern for what was being alleged, the council asked that I come and present history and where we are from a city involvement here. I also have City Attorney Carrie Sand available to answer questions related to this particular issue. And we also have the CEO, Chris West, and his representation available to answer questions. The intent was not to bring them in to create any type of debate. It was simply if the council had questions. We have somebody that is on, that you can hear from the other side of the argument, so that you can ask them directly. So Cascade Behavioral has been in the city for years, and we have had good years with Cascade, and we've had some trying years with Cascade. The most serious time that we've had was 5 years ago, and they had enough calls for service that met the criteria for our chronic nuisance ordinance that we stepped in and got involved with Cascade Behavioral back in 2016. At the time, there were calls that were drawing resources from the police department and the fire department. However, the calls weren't associated with safety as the argument came up and the concern came up last week. It was simply a reference to the drain on resources for the city, as with any chronic nuisance property does. We, at the time, addressed it, and we saw a drop in calls for service and the need to respond to that location. Since then, the administration and management for Cascade Behavioral has completely changed. Our calls for service have dropped significantly. However, over the last year, we went back and checked where this became a point of contention. We have looked, and there have been 7 calls that meet the criteria, and the chronic nuisance requires that there be 7 calls in a 12-month period to meet the criteria that where we could potentially label the entity as a chronic nuisance. However, one of the steps for the chronic nuisance ordinance would be to send a letter to the organization, letting them know of the issues that have come up, to bring it to their attention, and then to work with the city to resolve and reduce those calls. We have been working on a regular basis with them and trying to make sure that we have that relationship because of what has happened in the past. We haven't had these issues with the current administration. So the calls for service revolve strictly around patient-on-patient assaults, which we have to remember that this is an organization that is housing individuals that are challenged where these types of interactions might be expected. So where we have not received any reports of assaults on employees, this hasn't risen to the level where we as a city or us as a police department would have stepped in to label it a chronic nuisance, especially where the remedy is to work with the entity to try and resolve the issue, which we have been doing and are currently trying to do in this situation. So I thought I would open it up to the council if they had any specific questions that they might be able to answer, or Carrie, if you had anything to add before we go to that. If there are concerns, it provides an opportunity for us to be able to address where we go from here. David?
Council members, David Klein, City Administrator. I just wanted to also give you some new information since your last council meeting. Last week on Friday, the mayor, Mayor Ekberg, Deputy City Administrator Rachel Bianchi, and I met with our 11th legislative district representatives. I just want to make sure you know we spent an hour talking about the council's legislative policies and for their work. And this issue came up, and specifically Representative Hackney talked about being involved in this and recognizing it as a state regulated and a state funded organization, that he was also concerned. Oh, Deshaun, Councilmember Quinn, thank you. If you were going to talk about it, I didn't want to steal your thunder. Thank you. I appreciate that. But just want to make sure that Councilmember Delestrinas Johnson and Councilmember Edon recognizes that Representative Hackney was also taking some leadership role for the from Tukwila side at the state level, and looking to see how they could make some active improvements. So I want to give that information to all of you as well. There was some conversations, just so you know, that the city of Tukwila does not have any funding directly with Cascade Behavioral Health that we are aware of as well. State funded, state regulated, as far as we know. Thank you.
Thank you. Carrie, did you want to go?
Yes, thank you, Councilmember Delestrinas Johnson. So just to dovetail on what you heard from the chief and David, and I wanted to follow up on my remarks at your meeting last week on September 13th and just say, you know, when we heard from the public during public comment last week, you heard a lot of current employees at Cascade speaking about their safety concerns. And I mentioned at that time that it was our understanding that there was a labor management negotiation underway and that the city did not want to insert itself into that process to provide, you know, some balanced perspective and information. I think that's one of the reasons that the chief asked Chris West, Cascade CEO, to be available. And then also because the police department has been working with the management at Cascade just to try to make sure that there are appropriate safety protocols in place, such as training, appropriate screening of patients, and all of that. And I just wanted to mention that, you know, I talked about last week your police powers, that the city of Tukwila Council has broad police powers. And I remember seeing a lot of council members' heads nodding, because I know you're aware of that and you've probably been told that before in other contexts. But the reason I bring up your broad police powers is because before you try to consider legislating any potential solution here, it's important to remember that you need to have a good record of what is prompting that legislation. You know, that's our whereas recitals in our ordinances. We have whereas, and we're creating a legislative record, right? And we want to make sure we have a good balanced record and that we're hearing from all sides of the situation. So I just wanted to mention that, because I know I saw a lot of head nods when I brought up your broad police powers. So I'll just leave it at that. Thank you.
Thank you. Let's go with questions from council members. Councilmember Quinn.
I'll segue from that. And maybe by saying that my assumption is that we are going to have a series of conversations. I don't think we ever do kind of a one and done when something comes from the full council to us. And so I'm looking forward to this committee continuing to work on issues. I did have the opportunity to engage with the representatives, and it was a very in-depth conversation, and they have some concerns and issues that they're actually pursuing. It's pretty candid. But in the space of kind of how we got here, I'd be interested in, so this is the first question, I'd be interested in hearing from Cascade Behavioral Health about their understanding and commitment to public safety in the city of Tukwila, and what are some of the things that they're doing in addition to what Chief Drever has articulated. And I say that just get a sense of their understanding of why there would be a concern as this issue has come before. So that's the first question I have.
Sure. No, I can take that. Absolutely. This is Chris West. So I have been at Cascade for about 15 months now as the CEO. I've been in behavioral health for a little over 16 years. I'm a social worker by background. 10 years I served in the active duty Army, working closely with obviously police departments, fire departments, first responders, and all those roles. We have built a very strong relationship with the Tukwila Police Department. We meet monthly to discuss any issues that can expedite the service that we provide to the community, and also work with Deputy Chief Lund and his team to figure out how we can support any police department initiatives from a public safety standpoint. When this safety strike that we are saying is unlawful and unauthorized, we've filed a complaint, unfair labor practice, with the National Labor Relations Board. When this happened, we took action into really immediately ensure patient safety. We had 127 patients in house, and there was a very strong coordinated call off that happened, and staffing we had to bring people in from across the country. We were able to get licensed RNs and techs in to facilitate care. Our patient safety is our number one goal. So we went back and did a deep dive also into just how our safety statistics have been for the last 3 years, so since 2018. The three biggest things that stood out outside of all the other improvements were we have decreased any physical confrontations on the unit by 40%. So that's a huge decrease over the last 3 years. We've had our restraints go down 30% over the last 3 years. And elopements, which can be a big piece of milieu management, have gone down 80% over the last 3 years. So the teams that are picketing and striking are really responsible for some really great safety statistics. And I think that matches with what you said related to the calls and the utilization of our police force. So we, as Chief Drever stated, don't use the police to restrain patients or medicate patients. We're committed to a really strong patient safety. This past April, there were multiple national organizations with behavioral health that came out with a memo that I'm happy to share with the council that was endorsed by NAMI, National Council on Behavioral Health, National Association for Behavioral Health, that really stated that we are taking a stance against putting any type of uniformed security guards in psychiatric settings. It's been shown that the type and presence of someone like that would intimidate patients. They're not trained how to interact positively with psychiatric patients, as Chief Drever mentioned. So we are actively and continually looking at ways to improve safety and security. All of our staff are trained in a de-escalation, physical and verbal de-escalation technique that is called Handle with Care, and that's a nationally recognized de-escalation training. So all of our staff receive that, and the goal of that is they're able to therapeutically intervene with the patient that maybe going through psychosis that makes them aggressive or in some assaultive manner. So definitely committed to safety and security. We have also installed a fence around our facility when you talk about public safety. So we had Tukwila Police Department assist us in doing kind of a safety survey of how we can make our facility safer for our clients and our workers. So part of that was removing some tall brush along the back of our property. Part of that was installing a fence that goes completely around our facility. And we're also in the process of putting security cameras on the outside of our facility as well. So just, continue looking to continue the partnership with all of our public safety teams.
So I know this is not the last time we'll be here, and I have a bunch of questions, but I will yield back. But I do want to articulate, because Chief Drever talked about the chronic nuisance ordinance, and unfortunately it's those kind of things that have to be developed downstream, but upstream, there's work that needs to occur to reduce even the need to have to make calls, because you're making a commitment to monitor the process. And so what I would say is that sometimes the numbers don't tell the full story. I think we've experienced that, and unfortunately, I was here 5 years ago when there was a consistent challenge. So I look forward to continuing the discussion. I have more specific questions, and then maybe there's a way that we can kind of get maybe even have some pre-questions so we can have maybe a format where we can get some concise answers, because there is a lot more things that have been brought up that I think surround the public safety aspect, our responsibility as council members, and I would love to make sure that we get through those things so we can really assess every element.
Thank you. Councilmember Edan.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to thank our staff and the chief for inviting the other side. I think we've heard one side, so thank you for doing that. Chief Drever, I wanted to ask you about the chronic nuisance calls. I think you talked about 5 years ago. And it also talked about 7 calls. And I was trying to hear when did that 7 recent calls happen?
The ordinance requires 7 calls in a 12-month period. So those 7 calls occurred over the last year. So they then push it to the threshold where technically it meets the criteria if we chose to address it as a chronic nuisance property. However, the ordinance itself provides for discretion in addressing it because there's reasons for it. For example, technically the mall falls within that criteria as well, but it's an entity that has, you know, what, 100-something different businesses in it, and then to ding the mall with a chronic nuisance, it doesn't make sense. So we have to evaluate each one on its own merit.
Thank you, Chief. I appreciate that. So for me, and I think for one thing, what I heard, I believe last Monday from especially folks that residents in our community are not hard to hear stories. I remember someone who's really, you know, someone's pregnant and got assaulted, and I know there's labor negotiations going on, but when I hear things like that, and anyone would not want anyone in that type of situation. So I am committed to make sure that folks that work there are safe. And I think from what we heard here tonight from Mr. West, he's also committed. So looking forward working with you in that. I yield back. That's all my comments on that.
Yeah, I would just say we definitely welcome anyone that wants to come and tour the facility. We've had multiple congressional, state, and municipal leaders come through, insurance companies come through. I think many of the stories and accounts that you've heard over the last month have been greatly exaggerated. So we're happy to kind of open our doors and show safety statistics and give you tours and things like that. So appreciate the time.
The reason why we're all here is because we're really concerned about some of the comments that were made at our last meeting regarding the employees not feeling safe. You talked a little bit, Mr. West, you talked a little bit about having security or certain types of security at Cascade. Can you talk a little bit more about that and just how you all have been responding to some of the incidents that happened? Because, I mean, it's Chief Drever had mentioned there had been 7 calls. It sounds like the police department or the city has discretion on when to take action, and that we're deciding, even though there were 7 calls, to not do so in this instance. So are we saying that we're satisfied with the safety measures that are being provided? And if so, can you describe some of those safety measures that are being put in place?
If I could clarify real quick before he responds, the 7 calls we had, as I mentioned, were patient on patient. And if a patient wants to report that they've been assaulted and without going into in-depth of each specific incident. And Chris can correct me if I'm wrong, my understanding is they are mandated on providing that opportunity. I think they also have access to phones to be able to do that, which the organization as a whole doesn't have control over that. So we do not have any reports that would substantiate assaults on employees.
Thanks, Chief. Yeah, that's accurate. So it's patient rights. Obviously, they have access to police intervention if there is something that occurs. We have, and keep in mind, seven incidents over a year. That's seven incidents. When you look at our population, that's over 45,000 patient days, right? So we are running 126 patients in our facility every single day. So over 365 days to have seven incidents over the course of 12 months, as the chief said. So looking forward, I mean, we have not had a spike in anything having to do with security or assault or safety of our staff or patients. And so there was nothing that prompted us to look closer at things we need to do for security. Through this, the safety strike that's occurring, the union has asked for security guards. That's something that, as I mentioned, is not recommended at all. It's something that is detrimental to the psychiatric milieu. So we are working with them collaboratively to come up with a solution. So we met on Thursday of last week, and we proposed the addition of a milieu manager, and that's someone who is not part of the staffing grid, but is trained in our handle with care, kind of as an expert, right? So like a train the trainer that is available to respond to any codes, right? So we use a code system. So if a patient becomes combative, staff members can call a code, and everybody who is available can respond to that in addition to the team that's on the unit to assist. And they're all trained with the same handle with care techniques to assist therapeutically. So we've offered to add someone that's out of all the units that's just on standby for any code that may be called to come and assist and run that code. So that's where we're at with negotiations. But at this time, we feel that the things that we have in place are very effective. We are actively hiring staff. And so the community really appreciates the statistics that we do have on safety and the milieus that we've been able to provide. So we had, as I mentioned, 127 patients. And this is, again, to this question of security and safety and do we feel like we're doing what we need to. 127 patients. We had to reduce down to two units out of six, and that brought us down to 50 beds. And so for the month of August, there were 80 beds, 80 beds offline. Which is very detrimental to the community right now. As you all know, there's 18-hour wait times for ERs, and we've had multiple calls with Medicaid and HCA trying to figure out how we can get our beds back online because patients are, dying waiting to get into the ERs, and a lot of psychiatric patients are boarding in the ERs. So we have been actively hiring. So we went from 50, we're now up to 68 beds, and we're hoping in the next 14 days to get up to 92. So we have, we've hired 11 RNs within the pipeline so far and about 22 behavioral health technicians to come on board. So we are actively working to get back to the community. We understand it's a huge need. There's a huge resource that is not there in the facility that we provide. And so we're trying to get those back online as quick as we can to serve the community. We are we're a larger employer. We have 390 employees that work within the facility. So we definitely feel like safety and security is paramount, and has not wavered at all.
Thank you. I'm a little perplexed because we heard instances from people who work at Cascade who report that assaults happened on them, and so our police taking reports from people who have been assaulted? Do we not do like incidents in the past? Like I'm just trying to understand how the seven reports could be only from patient on patient, but there are reports that were given at the meeting from people who work there, but none of them have been captured by our police department?
Well, I think that's an inaccurate way of describing it. If we get called there for an assault, we go there, we take a report. The most recent incident that has triggered a lot of media around Cascade Behavioral, we did get called there for a report of an assault on an employee. However, the investigation showed that it was not an assault on the employee, but actual poor tactics used by the staff to do a pig pile to control the individual. And an employee got hurt while they were doing that, but not by the person that was, the patient they were dealing with. And so we don't use pig pile tactics because that you can't control the situation. That's what happened in that one specific one. And we met with labor, we discussed that. And when we left that meeting, they agreed, yes, that's what happened. But we're not taking an assault and potentially charging a patient with a crime if they're not responsible. That is the only incident that I'm aware of that has been reported as an assault on an employee that, as we investigate, find out that it actually was not. And so they then, after our meeting, went out and told media that it was an assault on an employee, even though we had just sat there and agreed that it was not. So I'm not arguing credibility. I'm just reporting on the facts that our officers are having to deal with. And so we have not had one of those reports. So if we have, and I can dig further and look and go and pull all those case reports to see and determine, but I do know that we talked with Cascade Behavioral to address your very concern, and the response we got from them was their own internal investigations show that there has not been a report of an assault on employees. So you have our law enforcement response as well as you have the internal response.
I know we're getting in, this is a fact finding. The purpose of this meeting is for us to get an update and really to get down to what the issues are. We're all concerned about safety of those who work at Cascade, safety of those who are patients at Cascade. We're not going to resolve all the issues tonight, but I do appreciate everyone who is here to just provide more information to us as we try to really understand what role we can play to assist those in our community. I don't have any further questions. I think a lot of the questions that I came here with have been answered through this process. I want to check with my council members to see if they have any additional questions. We do have one more item on the agenda. So I want to be able to get to that because I know Tracy has been waiting, but I also do want to leave a couple minutes before we close the meeting for Laurel to explain to anybody who is on the call how to provide public comment if you do want to provide public comment at our council meeting starting at 7, since I don't think there'll be enough time for public comment in this meeting. Council members, do you have any final questions?
I'm hoping we can continue to again elevate information so we're clear exactly what is occurring and having the ability to ask questions, and then also acknowledging, yes, the need of this facility across the region fundamentally, and knowing that I think having that ongoing communication is going to be important so that we can do our due diligence. And so I feel like there's more to do, but because we've been made aware of situations and key access keys missing and all that, we can't ignore those type of things. So if we can think about continuing the conversation to make sure not only for the general public safety, but also we depend on 150,000 population during the day, and it doesn't matter what the job is that they do. Their safety is important. So, you know, the goal is to get to the bottom of information so we can do our due diligence.
Thank you. All right, we will move on to the next agenda item. It's an update on Foster Memorial Park soccer fields, and Tracy. I'm sorry, I'm really excited about the next meeting. I don't know what to call you right now. Acting director, but not for long. Go ahead, Tracy.
Good evening, everybody. Good evening, council members, city staff, and community members. Thank you for this opportunity to come to you to give you just a brief update. I know you're raring to go to the next meeting. And so I've heard through a few different channels, you know, this interest in turf soccer fields. And that was something that was identified in the PROS plan at actually two different locations, the need for kind of a larger turf synthetic field. So the kind of the process that we're going through right now is, I think part of this interest and need also came through a community group, the Smalley Health Board. And so I have done some one-on-one reach outs with them. We actually did a tour of some facilities in Tukwila. We really wanted to kind of understand what their needs were. And actually what we found out was their need wasn't necessarily for like large soccer fields, but what they are in need of is small side soccer fields so that they can develop the game, young players, give them lots of touches and playing time. So that was really eye-opening for me, really to try to understand what that need was. And then think of different ways that we could address that need through our park system, through our CIP. So we certainly can continue to look at turf fields that is on our CIP program, but it is kind of long range. It's not even on the 21 to 26 year plan. It's farther out because it's a big investment. And so we really need to make sure that we think about where those fields might be. Like I said, the two places identified were Foster and at Tukwila Community Center. And from previous meetings, we kind of know that at Foster Memorial Park, maybe there's some more work to be done before we consider putting something large like a turf field on that site due to the proximity to neighbors and some of the other issues we have around that park. So I think there could be some more study about what's the appropriate location for that. But one of the exciting things that I found is there are some really great, they're called temporary field solutions, and it's through the, there's an urban soccer park program or a company, and you can put in these temporary fields that really last 10 years, but they are small side and you can configure multiple fields at different locations. And they're typically around $200,000 a field, which is really affordable. And so I think what we could consider doing in the coming year is find out, you know, if that's the something we want to try, figure out what the right location is. We did get some good priority locations from our meetings with the Somali Health Board and their soccer coaches and got some really good input on what they're looking for in a location. They really want to be at a park, but they also are really conscious about being good neighbors to the people that surround the park. So that was really great to hear and, you know, really good consensus on what that might look like. So we did kind of tour a few different potential locations, and then we kind of committed to maybe doing some more reach outs to other soccer organizations so that we really made sure that we have a good understanding of everybody's needs before we get into this. But the other opportunity is, you know, we have to look at our funding sources, not only where our field locations, but our funding sources. And the Washington Recreation and Parks Association, as you know, earlier this year did what they called the SEEK grant that helped enrichment programs this summer. And it was through some of the ARPA funds that they received, and it was with the School District and the WC or AWC. And so they're going to have another funding cycle, and we can apply for up to $250,000. So we thought maybe this is a great thing to apply for, is to try to get one field and figure out a good location for that, see how this amenity works, and if it really does start meeting some of the needs, and then we can kind of proceed with a longer range plan. So
thank you, Trace.
Any questions?
Yeah. Yep. Councilmember Quinn, do you have any questions? Councilmember Edan?
Thank you, Tracy. Appreciate you being here and giving us an update. I've been talking about this for a long time. There is definitely a need, and I can go into why, but I don't think we have a lot of time. But you worked with an organization and Smart Health Board, and they seem to really look into a lot of options, which is really good. I like what you said about the temporary fuel solution. I like what you said about the grant. There's some grant opportunities coming up. So I think one of the things I want to throw it out there was we should definitely look ways to fund the temporary fuel solution now, and put a caveat in there and say we will go for the grant. If we don't end up getting the grant, then we will proceed with our city funded process. And to that, that's one of the things I would like to put it out there and see what your thoughts are. I'm not looking for a response now, but just keep it aside and maybe come back and let us know what the direction is after you talk to other folks, because I believe this is, we have a basketball that you can go in the court and hoop. We got a tennis court, you can go and play tennis. But we don't have a soccer field where you can go and kick around a soccer ball. With that, the other that we have is you really have to pay for it. Looking for ways that we can make sure that we're serving all of our communities. So I yield back. Thank you.
Thanks, Zach. I also like this idea about temporary small fields, and I just love that you're working with the Somali Health Board to understand what the need is and working collaboratively with them as they've run this soccer program in our city and around South King County. And so I just think it's great. And I just want to thank you for taking the time and effort to really follow up on that. But I do like this idea about these smaller temporary fields for now, as we figure out, long-term funding for some of those bigger turf fields that we envision.
Right. Yeah, I think it's really going to be a matter of, we have some forecasted funds for our CIP that are towards kind of large bucket projects. And so we have to put this to the community to say, what's the priority? We had, some ideas out there, and we can put together what kind of our proposed list of project is for 2022. For council review and or community input, so we can say what's your priority, where do you want those funds to go. I think we gather some of that in the PROS plan, but I think it's our duty when we get closer to implementing and spending some of these dollars that we go back out to the community and really make sure we heard what they said and make sure we understand their priorities, and that includes location and you know, understand what the costs are and everything like that. So I look forward to working with you all on that process.
Thank you, Tracy. At this point, I want to release my council members just so they have time to use the bathroom. We only have 5 minutes. But Laurel, could you give just a quick update on and how somebody can go make public comment? Council members, you can go, you know, do what you got to do. But for those who are interested in making public comment, I just wanted to give them information on how to do so at the next meeting.
Thank you, Councilmember Delestrinos Johnson. To make public comment at a city council meeting, we ask that you sign up in advance due to the virtual meeting environment by emailing citycouncil@techwillowa.gov by 5 p.m. that day with your name and the subject that you wish to speak to. If anybody is on the line right now who wishes to make public comment at the meeting that starts in 4 minutes, I can stay on a little bit longer to take your name down. But then I'll have to switch over to the other meeting.
I got a couple of people, more than one.
Okay, so I am starting a document with
your email. If you put in the chat your email, I'll send you a couple of names.
Okay, that would be great and very helpful. Thank you so much.
Mm-hmm.
All right, thank you, everyone. Have a good night.
Thank you, Chair. Appreciate it.
Yep. Thank you, Laurel.
Thank you.